and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the relentless nature of the Trump administration's government by stunt and spectacle, and Trump's constant assault on our political, legal, economic, cultural, and social structures in a tyranny of the minority, which is demoralizing the outraged majority, making us numb, and weakening our resolve to fight back. Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate magazine and hosts the podcast Amicus, joins us to discuss her article at Slate, "It's All Too Much, and We Still Have to Care." With growing signs of outrage as two-thirds of Americans now disapprove of Trump's cruel border policies separating young children from their mothers, we'll discuss the warning by the head of the Poor People's Campaign, the Reverend William Barber, that, quote, "we lose only when we get quiet." And since Republican women like former First Lady Laura Bush and even Melania Trump, with a conspicuous silence from women's and children's advocate Ivanka Trump, are speaking out against the callous inhumanity Trump, Sessions, Kelly, and Stephen Miller are displaying in the name of the American people, there are signs that truth and justice will prevail in the end. Then we'll speak with Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Propaganda Works, whose forthcoming book is How Fascism Works. He joins us to discuss the extent to which Donald Trump has weaponized the advice of the Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels to, quote, "make the lie big, keep it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it." Amid signs that Trump's campaign to discredit the Mueller investigation is working, with 36% now having an unfavorable opinion of Mueller and just 32% approving of the inquiry, we'll discuss how, thanks to Fox News and other pro-Trump propaganda outlets, propaganda is working for Trump and America is getting closer to fascism. Then finally, we will look into the FIFA World Cup underway in Russia and the surprising defeat of the soccer powerhouse Germany by Mexico, a victory undermined by Mexican fans chanting a homophobic slur, which FIFA is now investigating. Andre Markowitz, professor of comparative politics and German studies at the University of Michigan and author of Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism and Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture, joins us for an update on the world's most watched sporting event. And joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate magazine and hosts the podcast Amicus. And she has an article at Slate, "It's All Too Much and We Still Have to Care." Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you for having me back.
And Dahlia, you're a journalist trying to cover Trump. It's exhausting. We have government by stunt, by spectacle, by distraction. And yet I have to remind myself that the majority of Americans are not happy with this government and don't support it. I think we have about 65% against, 35% for. So since we have a tyranny of the minority, what's wrong with the majority?
Well, I think that we have a structural problem where we have all three branches of government are controlled by one party. I think that that is attributable to all sorts of things, vote suppression, vote purges, gerrymandering, all the sorts of things that mean that the majority of the country did not necessarily elect this president by virtue of the Electoral College and this Congress by virtue of gerrymandered seats and all that. So I think you have, and then state houses that are doing what they can, I think, to dilute the force of the voices of a lot of people in this country. So I think you have a series of systemic changes that have gone over for decades that have meant that you can have sort of one-party rule in a country despite the preferences of much of the country, if not most of the country.
So in terms of what we can cling to, if you will, or build upon, that might be a better way to put it, we now know that two-thirds of Americans disapprove of President Trump's border policy of separating children from their mothers. We've seen the iconic picture on the New York Times cover of the two-year-old Honduran child bawling her eyes out while her mother's being frisked up against a car. And we learned that two-thirds of Americans disapprove of this. About 58% of Republicans approve of what Trump is doing. So you do have a majority there. You have also have, I think, a breakdown in terms of the parties. I think, roughly speaking, 60% of women in this country vote Democrat and 60% of men vote Republican. Is there a way to build the coalition against Trump via Republican women, given what former First Lady Laura Bush wrote in the Washington Post, a very powerful piece condemning what Trump is doing?
It certainly seems as though between Laura Bush and even the more tepid version that Melania Trump released, I think that it's safe to say that women don't necessarily have the stomach for images and audio of children being ripped from their parents and warehoused in camps and in cages. I think the question is whether that can build into something more than a lot of Facebook posts and angry tweets. So I have seen in the past 24 hours a real uptick in folks, for instance, calling their congresspeople, calling their senators, saying sign on to Dianne Feinstein's effort to remedy this. I've seen a lot more talk of marches and protests, but people are wary. I mean, people marched for the Women's March, they marched for the climate, they marched for the Parkland kids. And I think that the real question isn't, are these actions outrageous? Is this an unspeakable horror that we are doing something under this guise of zero tolerance for for people smuggling children across the borders, and that's not, in fact, a policy that needed to be enforced. It could be corrected with the stroke of a pen or with one phone call to Jeff Sessions. I think that we can agree that this is a horror, but the question is whether people still have the wherewithal to be activated and to feel as though their voices can make a difference. And I think that really is the nut of the question we have right now is, you know, journalism is doing its job. Courts are doing their job. I think that senators who went to the borders this past weekend and Congress members who went to the borders, visited the shelters and reported back, they're doing their job. The real question is whether the public still has the wherewithal to say, not just, this is upsetting, I can't bear to listen to the audio, but I need to do something. And I'm not sure I can answer that question right now.
Well, obviously, it's frightening the pace at which the country's being reshaped by this minority president who is destroying the environment, stacking the courts, enabling and rewarding the richest Americans while punishing the poorest. It's hard to sort of take. And when you talk about zero tolerance in terms of Jeff Sessions and what this abomination, which amounts to child abuse going on in the name of the American people on the southern border, it does, zero tolerance becomes zero humanity. But nevertheless, in your article, you talk about having spoken with the Reverend Barber, who's leading the Poor People's Campaign, and how he inspired you and said, "We lose only when we get quiet." So I guess that's the message, isn't it? In spite of everything, you can't allow yourself to be defeated by the actions of the Trump administration, but rather you've got to find a way to summon the strength and purpose and determination not to allow him to win, because power is what you give away, is it not?
It is, and I would really commend to anyone listening to go back and listen. I interviewed the Reverend Dr. William Barber on my podcast on Amicus a week ago, and it really was a bracing reminder, not just that we can't be quiet, but also that we tend to treat this moment as this strange, unerringly dramatic reality show, and all we see is Donald Trump and Sarah Huckabee and Stormy Daniels. And his point, and I emphatically needed this reminder, is that no, there are people all over the country. They may not be visible. They may not be the subject of every single second of television coverage, but there are people suffering. There are people who are hungry. There are people who are, you know, in housing that is falling apart. There are people who you know, have a horrific illness who stand to lose if the Affordable Care Act is eviscerated. And all of these people are us. We have to keep them centered and not center the story that we're being fed. And I think that it's a paradox because, of course, we're all recoiling at what Donald Trump is doing and what John Kelly is saying in defense and what Jeff Sessions is saying when he cites the Bible. But it isn't an end in itself to recoil, that you have to then take that in, absorb it, and figure out what action you're going to take, and whether it's donating the money to folks who are helping the families who are separated at the border, or whether it's volunteering your time as a translator, which it turns out is essential right now to have people who speak Spanish working at the borders, or whether it's marching or calling. There is so much we can still do. There is so much change we can effectuate. But I think the idea that the intensity of the spectacle and the horror is numbing is the long game. It's the plan to have us go numb. And I think part of the reason I wrote that article is that I think I'm really concerned that as we go numb, we open the door for more horrors ahead, and that we cannot be in a position where nothing shocks us or nothing surprises us, or we feel so utterly powerless that we can't move, because that really is when the bad stuff will come rushing in.
Well, just in the last minute, Dahlia Lithwick, of course, not only can we not afford to go numb, we also have to be alert to the constant mendacity. The Republicans are debating two bills. I spoke yesterday with the ACLU's chief lobbyist on immigration, and she said that both of these bills are appalling, but actually Paul Ryan's bill is even worse and more heartless, even though it's dressed up in phony compassion. So I think that surely at the end of the day, this is the job of journalism, is it not, to try and at least keep the public abreast of what's happening, because the mendacity is relentless and it can't be overwhelming.
That's true, but I think I would also say that I noticed a massive uptick over the weekend in even mainstream press calling out things that were not true, and that the headlines across the boards this past weekend said Donald Trump falsely claims the Democrats made this law. Donald Trump again insists untruthfully that the Democrats are solely to blame. And I do think that journalists are starting to do the thing that admittedly we should have done 2 years ago, which is call out mendacity when we see it and not be afraid of saying, if something is in fact factually indisputably wrong, we have to make that the heart of the story. And I do think that is changing. Again, I think it took too long. But I think that in addition to journalists calling things out, we need to realize that journalists are also overwhelmed by the chaos, trying to write 5-6 stories a day, trying to track when the DHS says it's a policy, but it's not a policy. It's a policy, but it's a deterrent, but it's also not the law, but it's also the law. That's an incredibly difficult project. So it's not just the mendacity, it's the ephemeral nature of truth. And I think that people really have to be partners in this effort and to fight back when things are purveyed as truth and we know them to not be true, whether it's language or ideas or the concept of rule of law. I think it's so important for folks who feel paralyzed by the nihilism to push back and say, no, words still have meaning, policies are still policies, laws are still laws. And to do that work is not just the work of journalists.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate magazine and hosts the podcast Amicus. And she has an article at Slate, It's All Too Much, and We Still Have to Care. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the extent to which Donald Trump has weaponized the advice of the Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels to, quote, make the lie big, keep it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it.
I feel pain of everyone. When the Fuhrer says he is the master race, we hail, hail, right in the Fuhrer's face. Not to love the Fuhrer is a great disgrace. So we hail, hail, right in the Fuhrer's face. When Herr Goebbels says we own the world in space, we hail, hail, right in Herr Goebbels' face. When Herr Goering says he'll never bomb this place, we hail, hail, right in Herr Goering.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of four books, two on epistemology and one on the philosophy of language and semantics and one in social and political philosophy. And his latest book is How Propaganda Works, and his forthcoming book is How Fascism Works. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Stanley.
Thank you, Ian.
And it would appear that propaganda is working in terms of what President Trump has managed to do in terms of driving down the favorability of Robert Mueller, a lifelong Republican, Vietnam War hero. They've managed to frame this as a partisan witch hunt, and apparently it's working. According to Politico Morning Consult poll that came out recently, Robert Mueller's favorability is just at 32%. More people, 36%, have an unfavorable opinion of him, and 32% have no opinion whatsoever. And among Republicans, a total of 53% view Mueller unfavorably. That's up from 27% in July. And even some of the Democrats have fallen out of favor, Mueller has fallen out of favor with some of the Democrats. Now 24% see Mueller unfavorably, as opposed to 21% in July. So are we to conclude that what Donald Trump is doing, muddying the waters, making up phony issues, attacking relentlessly the FBI, the DOJ, Comey, and the Mueller inquiry, is it working?
Yes, it's working. It's a very effective strategy. It's what other authoritarians have done in his position. If you look at what Erdogan did in Turkey recently, he undermined trust in the security apparatus. Of course, you know, the security apparatus is in any state. This, the United States and Turkey, no doubt, have been involved in complex and nefarious activities in the past. And you can use that history against them. All the more reason going forward for everyone to remember that our security apparatus must always be above board. Because if they're not above board for any reason, for instance, as we were during the Iraq War, then authoritarian leaders can use that history against them. And that's what we're seeing now. What Trump is doing is he's raising paranoia about a deep state, so-called deep state hunt against him. And I just wish that our security apparatus had been fully uncriticizable until this moment. But, of course, one could say no security apparatus is. But that's what we face.
Well, the security apparatus itself is on trial today in the U.S. Senate before the Senate Judiciary Committee with testimony from the Inspector General of the DOJ, who wrote this recent 568-page report, largely about nothing, really, when you look at it in the proper context. If anything happened, Comey helped elect Trump. That's just absolutely plain to see for all. But they're trying to make such a big deal out of it that somehow everything was done against Trump. The deep state was out to get him. This FBI agent and his girlfriend, an FBI lawyer, had made some remark as though one FBI agent can bring down a candidate. Trump is beating the drum about that. But before the Senate today, you know, some of the, even Orrin Hatch and others, don't seem to be that enthusiastic about beating up on Christopher Wray, the FBI director, and Horowitz, the IG. Lindsey Graham is feigning all kinds of indignation. How could this happen with my FBI? They've gone after my party, the Republicans. It's absolute nonsense. But how did you get that kind of complicity? I mean, are they literally following the Fuhrer's orders here by the Republican Party in the Senate, who you'd expect a little more of than the House, of go ahead.
Donald Trump has a large degree of support from base primary voters. And unfortunately, if we were to make analogies with the past, the past suggests that when conservatives collapse, or when the center-left collapses, as you could say happened, or socialist party, democratic socialist party collapse, as you could say happened in Venezuela, then they become complicit with authoritarian extremists. And, if that structure is in fact what we're seeing, then it's very worrisome. We need, in a liberal democracy, for our institutions to follow out their role and to preserve, for example, the separation of powers, because history, even recent history, suggests that when that doesn't happen, when people lose the rules of their institutions in exchange for political favors or to retain political positions of power, as seems to be the case here, then it enables authoritarian. So if authoritarianism is what we're seeing, then we're also seeing a very classic structure of the authoritarian party, be it, the leftist party or the right-wing party, going along with them and throwing their principles out the door. And that's very dangerous. So everyone has to ask themselves, are they enabling potential authoritarianism? And that question would arise whether whatever the political ideology of the leader is. And in this case, it's the Republican Party that has to put constraints on him. And it's extremely worrisome that we're seeing them not doing that.
And again, I'm speaking with Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of four books, two in epistemology, one in philosophy of language and semantics, and one in social and political philosophy. And his latest book is How Propaganda Works. And his forthcoming book is How Fascism Works. Well, it feels almost more like it's Orwellian than authoritarian. I mean, not that those Orwell didn't write about authoritarianism in the deepest and most profound way. But nevertheless, when you have the kind of Ministry of Truth situation where the Republicans and Trump are becoming the victims when they were the victors, Comey helped elect this guy. That's just clear. Hillary Clinton thinks that. And most analysts at the time thought, my God, and I remember watching Trump at the time. He was basically giving up because these pollsters told him he was going to lose. And as soon as Comey came on a few days before the election and came up with this ridiculous thing that turned out to be nothing involving extra Hillary Clinton emails, suddenly Trump had a spring in his step and he was back on the campaign working hard. And he only won by 77,000 votes, so it was a close one at that. I mean, this is what drives me nuts, is that I feel like I'm literally caught in some kind of Orwellian distortion here.
Just a small footnote on Orwell. One thing Orwell got importantly wrong in 1984 is he said that he suggests that Winston, the main character, needs to be tortured or consistently sort of like placed under interrogation to believe the nonsense and the conspiracy theory. History shows that conspiracy theories are, in fact, very easy to believe, and what's difficult for people to accept is reality. What Trump has successfully done is he's introduced the not conspiracy theories into the public discourse that his followers simply do not believe any media that reports the opposite of what he says. So that is a function of distorting the public space in the way that he has done. He has spread so many conspiracy theories about the mainstream press that he can dictate his own truth.
Well, we've seen that on display most vividly on Friday in the driveway of the White House, where a gaggle of reporters, one of whom, by the way, said rather plaintively, "Why are you lying?" But she was drowned out by all the other reporters shouting questions. So if there was some kind of solidarity amongst the press, maybe they could force both Trump and Sarah Sanders to stop lying and answer questions. But Trump clearly, I mean, the idea that the Democrats are to blame for what's happening, separating children from their parents at the southern border, is extraordinary. Again, it's Orwellian. And, you know, a man who's literally guilty of child abuse is blaming it on the Democrats. And somehow, I mean, is he getting away with this? I'm beginning to wonder whether he is, with his own wife writing or tweeting out a mild rebuke. And the former First Lady, of course, Laura Bush, with a very powerful op-ed in the Washington Post, is obviously appalled by what's happening. So
I worry that he is getting away with it. I think we have to operate on that assumption. I mean, his lies have been getting more and more extreme, and he's very sophisticated. A year ago, at least, I mean, his entire campaign, but we could have seen this coming a year ago. We could have predicted that every month, trust in the press was going to become further eroded. And the more it's eroded, the more you can get away with. So this has been going on for a very long time now. So one has to ask oneself, how much do his supporters believe the press, the mainstream press, the people who are reporting objective facts at all at this point? It's been so long. And obviously, Trump is very sensitive. He's a skilled politician who's sensitive to where, how far he's gone and what he's now able to get away with. And we know from other countries, from Law and Justice in Poland, from Erdogan in Turkey, from Chavez, we know that authoritarian leaders are able to discredit the media to such an extent that their followers simply do not believe the facts. And so the idea that America is somehow immune to this is absurd. Why are we, I mean, we are a great country, but why are we exceptional in that way?
Well, but we have a part of our media that are like the Pravda of the Republican Party, like Fox, Breitbart, which is not a big player and less so now, but Sinclair is a big player. And, you know, I'm reminded of the quote that's attributed to Joseph Goebbels, "Make the lie big, keep it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it." And there's complicity, isn't there? I mean, as much as I find Trump disgraceful and scary and dangerous, I also think Rupert Murdoch has a lot to answer for.
Absolutely. I mean, you couldn't simply discredit the mainstream media on your own. You need an alternative press corps that does your bidding. And we've seen that. We've had that in place for many years before Trump. So we've had that entirely in place. Goebbels' quote is very important to remember, because Goebbels' insight was a very simple narrative, makes more sense, repeated often, makes more sense to people than the complexities of reality. You refer to a 500-page report. No one is going to digest a 500-page report, but they will digest very easily the following message: the FBI is out to get our leader. That's a very simple message. It makes sense. It makes sense of a welter of complexity, of the drip-by-drip pieces of news that have been coming out. And people, unfortunately, have the proclivity to accept a simple narrative that makes sense to them over reality, which is always too complex.
So in other words, Trump ginning up this phony Spygate issue was able to find in these 568 pages 7 words, a transcript from a text, I believe, between Peter Strzok, the FBI agent, and his girlfriend, who was an FBI lawyer. And by the way, the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing today, it was revealed that the FBI had to go to the Department of Defense to crack this text open. And they're all making a big fuss over that. The senators are. But the 7 words were pretty much like, you know, she says to him, Lisa Page, he's not going to become a president, is he? And that was a feeling I think a majority of the Americans felt at the time. My God, I couldn't believe this candidate, Trump. Surely he's not going to be president. Surely the American people aren't going to vote for this guy. That was a pretty pervasive feeling over in a majority of the population. And then he says something like, no, it's not going to happen. We're going to stop it. And that's what he seized on, just those few words. So that doesn't that make the point that you're making?
Yes, you can always take out-of-context stuff. You can isolate one little thing and use it to, like, buttress a simple narrative that just obscures the rest of everything, because reality is complex. I mean, all the FBI agents that were incredibly against Clinton, you can just erase their existence by just having a simple narrative, and you just need to cherry-pick one little piece. You might not even need to cherry pick. At some point in the future, he won't even need any bit of reality. But it always helps to have one bit of reality to pick from, because who has the time nowadays to assimilate the larger complex story? So, you know, a simple story, they're against him, they're out to get him. That makes sense to people. They can shut the book. And unfortunately, history suggests that people are more inclined to accept a simple narrative that makes sense of their biases already than spend the time to evaluate a more complicated set of facts.
And do you think...
And in this case, it's not even a complicated set of facts. The 500-page report doesn't in any sense exonerate Trump. It doesn't even bear on Trump. So it's like, it's utter... confusion.
Well, just in closing, Jason Stanley, there obviously is an asymmetry here because unlike the Watergate hearings, which we all saw on television as they unfolded, Mueller is working in secrecy and not a word from him. Meanwhile, Trump is able to go out there and create this alternative reality about what Mueller is doing and how it's all about there's no collusion. And of course, the issue has never been collusion. The issue is whether or not Trump is the instrument of a foreign power. The foreign power is a former KGB guy. He knows how to run operatives. You don't collude with them. You just send them on their way, and they don't even know half the time what they're doing. It's the polizhny durak, useful idiot. But that aside, my sense is that there's also media fatigue on the political left. If you watch MSNBC, it's all Mueller all the time because they're left to speculate because, again, the asymmetry is we're speculating about what Mueller is doing, whereas Trump can create this alternative reality.
So that when Mueller delivers his report, no one believes it because he will have undermined trust in our institution before that. And that worries me more than anything, because I'm like any American, I'm waiting to hear the facts and keeping an open mind until then, although what's already in the public domain is very worrisome. However, the president is certainly not acting like he's innocent because he's actively undermining trust in these institutions. And, you know, to me, regardless of political party, the institutions need to be defended. And I think it's also a wake-up call as we go forward in this country about the need to keep these institutions completely honest, because we can't have this level of paranoia about our institutions. It's proven too easy to raise this kind of doubt about these institutions. And so, you know, we need to be aware that the way authoritarians function is by undermining trust in any institution that might check them. And so that's why institutions always need to be honest and always need to be above board. So, if authoritarianism is what we're seeing, then, I think we all need to assume that, that this is a possibility at this point and behave accordingly. And if this is what we're seeing, then yes, he's undermining trust in the very institutions that are meant to check executive power.
Well, just in closing, I'm afraid that The words of Joseph Goebbels are echoing across the decades here. Make the lie big, keep it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it. A sad note to end on, but I think a very realistic one, I'm afraid. And I thank you for joining us, Jason Stanley.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jason Stanley. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of four books, two on epistemology, one on philosophy of language and semantics, and one in social and political philosophy. His latest book is How Propaganda Works, and his forthcoming book is How Fascism Works. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an update of the FIFA World Cup underway in Russia.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México, 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 México.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andrei Markovits, who's the Karl W. Deutsch Collegiate Professor of Comparative Politics and German Studies at the University of Michigan. He's written on topics as varied as German and Austrian politics, anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, the European right and the European left. And his books include Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism, and Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrei Markovits.
Thank you for having me again. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Andrei. And are you in mourning at Germany's loss to Mexico?
No, wait a minute. People always assume, this is so interesting, they always assume because I partly grew up in Austria, I speak perfect German, I'm a professor of German politics first and foremost, other than when I masquerade as an expert and also as a fan of sports, that I also always support Germany emotionally, which I don't. So I have not been, I'm not at all upset about this loss. I'm a little surprised, but not upset. So there is a huge discrepancy in my case between knowledge and affect. So just because I know something about Germany doesn't mean that I would love its soccer team.
Well, obviously, here in the United States, we don't have an American team playing. So
right. Oh, God.
So I guess Mexico is right next door, although our president doesn't seem to be particularly friendly towards Mexico and wants to build a wall to separate the two countries. Still, a lot of Americans, I think, behind Mexico. But do you think, as some of the commentators are now saying, that Germany's World Cup champions symbolize the country that has doubts about its own identity?
Oh, please, please. Oh, this is so silly. I mean, yes, Germany might have now all kinds of the IFD and the migrants, but that has absolutely nothing to do with the 11 guys who were playing on the pitch. I find, again, being a researcher in sports and other things, I find the merger of the two just so strained and so artificial, and this constant sort of characterological and larger issue about what happened. And no, the answer is no. They played poorly on some level, but it has absolutely nothing to do with Merkel's problems, with the CSU, now in Bavaria. It has nothing to do with the IFD. It has nothing to do with the role of Germany in the rest of Europe. It has nothing to do with the Holocaust. None of this. Out. No.
Well, if it's a phony issue vis-a-vis Germany, it does seem to be a real issue vis-a-vis the winners, Mexico, because of this chant of puto, which is a homophobic slang for a male sex worker. FIFA have announced that they're looking into a disciplinary procedure against Mexico because of the chants that were heard.
Rightly so. Rightly so. I actually was the keynote speaker a couple of weeks ago in Berlin about soccer and its horrible racism and anti-Semitism, and in this case almost only in Europe. But I find, again, I heard it yesterday, I think that, you know, it's very hard to legislate this. You know, basically you have 40,000 people, however many there are, and they all find themselves very strong, and they kind of, if anything, they are trying to be antinomian, basically to oppose what you're supposed to be doing. The soccer stadium is in many ways the last bastion of political non-correctness, okay? And it is, in fact, so the fact that FIFA and the rest of, or all these official places want the Mexican fans not to do this, eggs them on to do it. But I find it so sad that they themselves, and this can only be self-policed, that they themselves don't say, wait a minute, you can't do this. Okay, rather than regaling and rejoicing in the fact of basically defying FIFA and defying Mexican authorities and everybody up top. And it's really, it's disgusting. So there you have it. I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised about the massive homophobia that exists on soccer grounds. And again, it has to be self-policed. It has to be the guy next to you, when the guy next to you does this and you say, wait a minute, stop it, please. I'm here with my daughter, or I'm here with, or something, just to stop it. And as long as this is not seen as completely illegitimate by those that revel in doing it, it will be done. And I was actually surprised that they only did it at certain stages, not every time that the goalkeeper of both teams actually punted the ball, because it actually has been very common in Mexico to do it in both instances. But I think, by the way, the Mexican team played great. I was delighted the way they played. They really took it to Germany. They were not afraid of them. Everyone is. They showed them no sort of respect. I mean, in the sense of respect, yes, but sort of in the sense of fear. They're the champs, and they just took it to them. And, you know, they never beat Germany other than in a friendly, so they always lose to them. And finally, they beat them in a major game. And this is great. So that's great. But the fans is a different story.
And again, I'm speaking with Andre Markowitz, who's the Karl W. Deutsch Collegiate Professor of Comparative Politics and German Studies at the University of Michigan. He's written on topics as varied as German and Austrian politics, anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, the European right and the European left. And his books include Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism, and Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. So in terms of the Mexican fans at the World Cup in Russia shouting, chanting puto, which is supposed to put a hex on the opponents, but it looks as if it's done the opposite. It's put a stain on the Mexican team and on this victory. So I imagine there's some soul-searching going on in Mexico.
I hope so. I don't know Mexico well enough. I'm the most severe of possible critics of FIFA, you know, for many, many reasons. But in this case, and it's great. I think they're coming. This is the only way that they will understand. And I wouldn't be. I mean, they will not take away the victory, but this should be a serious. There should be serious consequences for this. And it was never taken, you know, basically it was always with a wink, wink, you know, and the rest of the world, especially the Americans, are dictating us what's politically correct. You hear this all the time now, everywhere. By the way, it's interesting, even with Trump. I came back from a big lecture tour of four European countries, and you hear it all the time. Your country, it's insane. It's between a Scylla of a crazy president and the Charybdis of political correctness gone mad about all this debate about appropriation and this and that. And what is going on there? And this falls under that category, that basically here you have authorities, in this case FIFA, egged on by the West Europeans and others to actually basically say that this is a bad slur and it should not be used. And clearly soccer fans, or any fans, but soccer fans just don't want to hear this. So I understand the anarchy or the anarchical dimension on the part of Mexican soccer fans, that they don't want to be told by FIFA or anybody what on earth they can shout. This is fine by my book. I'm an anarchist enough to do that. What I feel very bad about is that they don't self-censor themselves and don't understand that they're not shouting something completely innocuous, but they're shouting a very disgusting slur. And as long as that is not going to sink in, it won't help. However, if in fact, in this case, there will be some serious sanctions of some sort, money or basically where the Mexican Federation, all the, Chicharito Hernandez, whom I adore, is one of my favorite players who played so well for Manchester United. And so if Chicharito Hernandez should come out, go on public television in Mexico and say, stop it. This is disgusting. It's not only hurting us, but you should not be saying this. This is discriminatory. It's invasive. It's insulting. As long as that doesn't happen, I don't foresee it really changing. And obviously the next match is probably against South Korea. Yes, against South Korea, and which the Mexicans should win. I just expect it to continue. They will do this when the South Korean keeper punts the ball.
So what you mentioned, you've been on lecture tour in Europe and you spoke in Germany. What's going on there? You say that the people kept collaring you and saying, you got a crazy president. That's hardly breaking news. But Trump is even acting crazier and more hostile towards Germany than normal. He's now attacking Angela Merkel and saying, she has political problems because of her immigration, as if he doesn't have political problems because of his immigration policies here in the United States. And he's put this dreadful Stephen Bannon-like ambassador in there who's hanging out with the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, these horrible neo-fascists. The leader of the party described the Nazi era as merely a speck of bird poop in 1,000 years of glorious German history.
Let's not talk about Trump. I have no words anymore. Certainly nothing that can be said on. It's insane. I don't know what to say. The reason I brought this up is because not about Trump and not about his insanity and irresponsibility and I on and on we can go racism, all this. Although he's not a fascist, but that's a different story. You're interviewing me here about the World Cup, unless you want to make it about Trump, which is fine.
Please go ahead.
No. I just people in Germany, or not only in Germany. I was in Germany, Austria, Italy, Hungary, and all of these places. What comes up is a very interesting sort of. Everybody hates Trump. I mean, Trump is actually in some ways a very weak guy because he is, he's a prisoner of his own, his own house. He can't go to any regular, normal American college given a commencement address. He can't meet his beloved movie stars from Hollywood, whom he always wanted to have as his pals. I mean, in some ways, he's kind of this isolated guy, and because of his madness, FIFA might not have given the World Cup to the United States, which I'm thrilled about, in 2026, had it not been basically with the cover of Mexico and Canada. Especially Canada played an important role, because Mexico will now have the third World Cup, and no country ever has had more than two. But the United States alone might not have gotten it, and only because of Trump. And because the antipathy and hatred towards him is so intense. What I wanted to talk about, what I mentioned in the other context, is that it's sort of like a bifurcated place. On the other hand, you know, my European colleagues, mainly in this case at universities, whatever, they kind of sort of are amazed by the developments in the American liberal world, which to them is constraining. It's anti free speech. It's on and on and on. So it's kind of this bifurcated country, and this was only in the context of being egged on by the Americans and others for FIFA to clamp down on the Mexicans not to shout this insult. And I'm not surprised that in this case the Mexicans basically say, screw you. We will now, it's almost like a child. You know, you basically tell them not to do this, and then of course they will do it. So they did it, of course, yesterday as well. That was my point there.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's turn to the World Cup in Russia itself, and it seems that the reviews you're getting from people that are there say that it's going off very well, that Russians are being welcoming, and
sure,
people are surprised at how diverse everything is in terms of international food and shops, etc. I mean, obviously too many people have memories of the gray Soviet era. It's a very different country today, of course. But what are you hearing in terms of reviews?
No, I think I'm hearing exactly that. I'm not surprised. I must say it's mainly about Moscow and Leningrad. So I don't know what the shops are in Rostov on the Don, or in Volgograd, or Kazan, or something. So I don't know that. But and the stadia are all beautiful, and they just were built. This is what dictatorships do brilliantly, and there's no question. I know that Russian soccer is arguably one of the most racist. I mean, their fans are just the worst. I mean, they're constantly being fined. But I also had no doubt that the state was going to clean up these guys. And every single game is safe. There is no Nazi salutes. There are no chants. There are no flares. Nothing that goes on regularly when Spartak Moscow plays CSKA or Dynamo or of course Zenit St. Petersburg, which is, by the way, Putin's favorite team, one of the most right-wing, has a horrible fandom.
Right,
but
well,
these guys are all under check. They are under control. And, this is a very nice event. And I'm not surprised by how well it's being pulled off. And FIFA knows what it's doing. It basically takes over a country. And, even a country like Germany, actually, which was my last World Cup in 2006. I've been to six. And, they just run it. And they do it very well. And so the fans are all shuttled in there. It's all kind of it's like a Potemkin village, basically, for 4 weeks. It's a super Olympics. Olympics are always in a city. World Cups are in a country, or in actually occasionally two countries, and for the first time in 2028 in three countries. And, they are these major events that are really showcased, but in a very kind of skewed way. Most fans that are there are not interested in learning about Russia. They're there to support their team. And what I found actually very interesting, I'm just writing to a dear friend of mine who's a journalist there, what I found interesting so far is that in every single time, the European teams, whose supporters one would assume are first of all much richer than the Latin Americans and or people of Africa, and also closer, are completely outmanned in the stadium. I mean, yesterday the Mexicans had a home game. I mean, clearly it was something like 80-20 in terms of Mexican fans to German fans. Today, Tunisia against England, it was basically a home game for Tunisia.
They lost, the same,
it's a fascinating story for me.
Right.
How, in fact, I can go on with how Peru and these other countries actually dominate, or their fans who are coming from much further. Brazil, yesterday, Brazil-Switzerland was a home game for Brazil. So I don't quite know. I mean, I just emailed this to a friend, and he said, "Is this?" I asked him whether this was correct, and he said, "Absolutely." And now I want more details. But my impressions, having watched all 14 games so far, and I basically have taken off for 4 weeks, and this is what I'm doing. So I'll be watching, hopefully, every single game. I found this very interesting and totally unexpected that, you know, it would be in the Peru versus Denmark game, it was like a Peruvian home crowd. I find this fascinating.
Well, just in closing, Andrei Markovits, you mentioned the Russian teams. Dynamo, of course, used to be the KGB's team. So
yes.
I'm surprised that Putin doesn't support it.
No, I think that's a very good point. That's a very good point. Dynamo, everywhere in Eastern Europe, the Dynamos were the secrets of the secret police's team, and Lokomotiv was the working class team, or sort of the trade union team, actually. And then there was the army team everywhere, Chechia and Armata, and then Steaua in Romania, Honved, the great Honved team in Hungary, and of course in the Soviet Union it was CSKA, of course very well known in the United States for its hockey team.
Sure.
Which was sensational. But this actually completely disappears and in the 90s. And so Putin is from St. Petersburg, and he's a Zenit fan. So this by now really has completely, these things, I'm very impressed, Ian, that you know such details about Soviet football. And there was, of course, Spartak, which was an interesting case. It was kind of the outlier, occasionally sort of anti-regime even. It's a very, very interesting case. But
sure.
This is all completely washed up, washed out, and it's now, these are just clubs and have their own new supporters and whole new iconography and all of this. So it's nothing to do with the secret police.
Well, Andrei Markovits, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your enthusiasm for the game, and I'm unfortunately not able to watch it as much because I'm doing what I'm doing now. But I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian. I really appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrei Markovits, who's the Karl W. Deutsch Collegiate Professor of Comparative Politics and German Studies at the University of Michigan. He has written on topics as varied as German and Austrian politics, anti-Semitism and anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, the European right and the European left, and his books include Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism, and Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.